The finest workers in stone are not copper or steel tools, but the gentle touches of air and water, working at their leisure with a liberal allowance of time. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located just 752 kilometers from the John H. Chapman Space Center in London, Ontario, Canada. If there is one resource that the Martian surface offers in abundance, it is time. Where erosion and plate tectonics constantly remake the surface of the Earth, we see features on Mars that date all the way back to its warm and wet period in the era we call the Noachian, nearly 4 billion years ago. This slow-time landscape has been carved by volcanism, tectonism, and impact, abrasive wind, catastrophic outflow, and bitter frost in an extreme form of the landscape that inspired our opening quote by Henry David Thoreau. In part, because those changes are so slow, there are places where we can read the entire history of the surface of Mars, places like Gale Crater. From orbit, Gale appears to have a mix of features, some modern and some incredibly old. And it's not just the morphology that spans the gamut. The CRISM instrument on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter points to changes in mineralogy as we pass from older to younger sediments within the central mound of the crater. Now that's important because it suggests a changing environment, one that might have once been habitable and that we might be able to read in a similar way to how ice cores are examined on the Earth. Helping to deconvolve that record is Richard Leveillé of the Canadian Space Agency and a participating scientist on the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity. Dr. Leveillé is an expert on mineral formation in water and has a great deal of experience in extreme environments and their implications for life. As we speak, he is fully engaged helping to direct the actions taken by Curiosity on the Martian surface. However, I had the opportunity to speak with him at a conference in May. Enjoy the interview and wish us both the best in Pasadena and on Mount Sharp. Transitioning us tonight is Two Extremes by Daniel May and Stephen Wood from their score Journey into Amazing Caves. So you've got a connection to Western. Can you tell me a little bit about some of your PhD work?
Sure. I did my graduate studies at Western. So I arrived in 1995 to start a master's at the time. Things led to another, and that eventually became a PhD. So I graduated in 2001. And I basically worked on some interesting mineral deposits in some basaltic caves in Hawaii. And these mineral deposits were associated with, or are associated still, with sort of slimy microbial mats. Mats are coating the walls and ceilings of these caves. So the question was, why are these minerals forming, and what are they, of course, and what is the role of the microorganisms in these slimy rock coatings in the formation of those minerals? So it was kind of a microbial biogeochemical / mineralogical study to elucidate what was going on in these cave systems.
Okay, we see these microbial mats all over the place, in mines, in Antarctica, don't we? It's quite a common system.
Right, exactly. Partly because it's a sort of strategy of microbes to attach themselves to surfaces where there's maybe a little bit of water flowing on a rock surface, or where you get maybe films of water. So this is similar in some ways, as you said, to other situations. Or the common sort of comparison is sort of green algal slime on rocks in a stream. Sort of similar process, of course, in different systems. You may get different organisms in different communities colonizing the surface.
Okay, and they tend to do well in low lighting conditions, or more marginal conditions where other creatures may not be present?
In one cave systems, you tend to have maybe less higher organisms or grazers. So the microorganisms can sort of take advantage of that. But it's really highly variable depending on different environments and different systems.
Now, we've got caves in other places in the Earth. I mean, we've seen skylights on Mars. And any place that's seen volcanism is going to have things like lava tubes.
Correct. That's the thinking. We certainly know a lot about lava tubes on Earth. They're present in all kinds of volcanic areas. Recent, in the last few years, there's been a lot of evidence coming back from Mars and even the Moon on lava tube-like features, certainly features in lava flows that aren't necessarily cave systems, but evidence of lava tube formation. But we also do see these, as you said, these so-called skylights, which are openings into perhaps some subsurface cave-like area, which we can't quite yet peer into really with the orbiters we have. We try sometimes, for instance, with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to angle the cameras to try and look at what is underneath. Can we see walls of the subsurface, the void space? But it's really a little bit difficult. So we would expect these in volcanic systems that we have on Mars and on the Moon, perhaps even on Venus or Mercury, but we don't really have evidence from those planets yet.
So these days you're with the Canadian Space Agency. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what that agency does?
Well, the Canadian Space Agency basically looks after anything to do with space in Canada at the government level. We manage various programs and support various missions, and we're under the Minister of Industry. So a lot of what we do is to support Canadian industries to get things into space, fly things in space, whether they be satellites or instruments or hardware on planetary exploration missions like MSL. We also support a lot of activities at the university level to develop and maintain key expertise in Canada in the different space-related fields.
Now, you mentioned MSL. You're also involved with that mission as well.
That's correct. I was selected as a participating scientist in the NASA MSL Participating Scientists Competition. So I will be participating in that mission as a member of the science team, and I look forward to that.
Could you tell us just a little bit about your investigation? I know it has to do with ChemCam, and Roger Weens was on the show last season.
Right. So I proposed basically a sort of integrated, holistic approach using actually multiple instruments, including the ChemCam instrument, to try and really first target certain minerals that are of interest and then really definitively identify them using a combination of instruments. In particular, I'm proposing to target magnesium-rich clay minerals, which are interesting in that they would record areas where there's probably lots of water activity in the past. And so we can use ChemCam as our first sort of remote instrument to try and target some of these materials. And then with APXS and MALI, we can further narrow down that identification. And then really the clincher will be with ChemIn, the X-ray diffraction instrument. And from there, we can assess whether those materials are perhaps of interest for the SAM instrument, which, among other things, can analyze organic matter. So it's kind of a stepwise strategy to targeting and then identifying key mineral indicators of habitable conditions, basically, and possibly organic matter enrichments.
So Gale, which is the landing site, is that a good place to look for these minerals? And if you do find them, what will they tell us about this area?
So these minerals in particular, magnesium clay minerals, are quite common in obviously areas where you have magnesium and silicon solution. And they're mostly found in lake environments, at least on Earth, in lake deposits, for instance, or evaporation products in areas where you have evaporating fluids, in particular fluids that have interacted with mafic materials like basaltic rocks. Certainly on Mars, you have the source material, and depending on the aqueous activity or the amount of water and the duration of the water, you may have areas where rocks are leached, for example, and more mobile elements like calcium and magnesium, and to some extent silica, will move into another system, leaving behind the less mobile elements like aluminum and iron, for instance. And from that point on, you elevate the relative concentration of things like magnesium and silica, and then these minerals can form there. We also know that they tend to form at a certain pH range, mostly slightly above neutral pH, around pH 8 to 8.5. So they're really good indicators of certainly the pH conditions, but also the aqueous activity in that environment at the time.
You actually need sort of slightly alkaline conditions for that. Is that sort of what we see other places on Mars as well?
Yes and no. Mars is a big planet. It's diverse. It has diverse environments, both today and in throughout its history. So, for instance, the Phoenix lander, which went to the north polar region of Mars, actually was able to take measurements of the soil pH at the landing site and measured a pH of just above 8. Elsewhere, we find mineralogical evidence, for instance, the mineral jarosite, which we found at Meridiani Planum with the Opportunity rover. Jarosite, at least from what we know on Earth, it tends to form at lower pHs, generally below 5, even below 4. So that would tend to indicate acidic conditions. So the question then is there a pH of Mars, or, you know, what is the acidity of Mars? And it certainly varies from place to place and temporally over the history of Mars. Now, at Gale, we do have some information on the mineralogy, at least to some extent, and in some of the rocks that are exposed at the surface of Gale. We know this from, for instance, from the CRISM instrument on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And it does tell us that, especially in the lower parts of the mound in the middle of Gale Crater, or it's known as Mount Sharp, there are abundant clay minerals. And we know there's magnesium and iron-containing clay minerals. At least that's what we can gather from the CRISM data. And there's also evidence of aqueous processes within Gale Crater. People have proposed lake deposits. There's alluvial fan-type deposits and so on. And also due to its stratigraphic low-lying level, it's certainly a place where water would have accumulated just hydrodynamically. So the conditions are relatively correct for these kinds of minerals, so it's a reasonable assumption that we could find some of these.
You mentioned that Mars is a big place geographically, and a little bit about the temporal nature. I mean, this is an area where we might have actually a lot of sediment stacked one on top of the other, recording changing conditions, presumably?
Absolutely. Even from what we know now about, for instance, this large mound of what we believe are accumulated sediments, we do see a gradational shift from more clay-rich materials to more sulfate materials. And the interpretation so far is that the clays represent wetter conditions in the older part of time that's recorded in those sediments, whereas the sulfates represent a drier time when the planet as a whole started to dry up and water evaporated and you got things like sulfates being deposited. Now, that's sort of the simple story. When we look at the details of, for instance, the CRISM data, there is more to it than that. In some cases, we find sulfates stratigraphically below clays. We find mixtures. So it is probably a complex story, but curiosity is certainly up for the challenge. And by traversing along these exposed units, we will be able to really analyze the mineralogical and chemical compositions in detail, isotopic as well, and really get a better idea of those stratigraphic changes, which really are changes in time that are recorded in those sediments. So that will be an important part, and probably important part of the results of the MSL mission.
That makes sense to have a rover to actually go over this and try to distinguish what's actually in place, you know, bedrock, and what's sort of fallen down and mixed in and whatnot, because Mount Sharp is an erosional feature essentially these days. Now, in terms of the microbial mats that you studied back in caves, is an alkaline environment better for them or more of an acidic environment? Just to sort of tie that in.
Right, yeah. There are certainly biofilms and microbial mats in all kinds of systems, including acidic systems, including very alkaline systems. Bacteria and microorganisms more generally on Earth are very diverse and have really adapted to all conditions on Earth. Basically, wherever you have liquid water, you have some kind of life form, microbial life form. So I wouldn't say one set of conditions is better for development of microbial mats, but the chemistry of the system and the conditions of the systems, at least on Earth, will dictate who's there and what they're doing and what are the products, i.e. the minerals that form in that system.
I see. So it's just more about the organism itself rather than whether organisms are present at all.
Correct. So, for instance, if you go to a place like Rio Tinto in Spain, which is a river which is very rich in iron and other minerals and very acidic, it has a low pH. You do find microbial mats growing in the river on boulders and so on. For the most part, those are acidophilic organisms, so adapted to acidic conditions. And the kinds of minerals that form in association with those mats are iron-rich minerals, iron oxides, iron sulfates, and so on.
That's true, and you don't need a whole lot of water, do you? I seem to recall there are some of these communities in places like Death Valley that are very dry.
Sure. That's a whole other sort of set of adaptations that are, of course, very relevant to Mars. So, as you say, in places like Death Valley or all kinds of other desert regions, we do find microbial communities. And again, the formation or the development of biofilms and microbial mats can help in extreme arid conditions by sort of maintaining the little bit of water that does exist at times and so on. So certainly this is a widespread microbial strategy, if you will, in diverse environments.
Another question to ask is, before you were part of the CSA, back when you were working on these microbial communities, were you sort of thinking of the extraterrestrial applications of this, or was it just a terrestrial study?
It really was, at its origin, it really was purely terrestrial. And as I was getting started with my PhD, you know, and basically in the second year of my PhD, a paper was published by David McKay and others on a study they had performed on a Martian meteorite. And this, is, of course, is a very famous study and famous for the controversy, in part, that it spawned. So they claim that several lines of evidence that they found in this meteorite were pointing to remains of microorganisms, basically, that would have existed on Mars. So what struck me at the time was the kinds of materials I was looking at and the kinds of techniques I was using, and some of the questions I was posing in my work was very similar to what they had done in their study. So that was the first sort of indication that you can actually pose the question, is there life on Mars, and actually try and study it scientifically. But it really wasn't until several years after my PhD, when, although I'd had a general interest in Mars and extraterrestrial life, it really became a part of my job when I joined the Canadian Space Agency to actually develop methods to search for life on Mars, develop ways to explore Mars, and so on.
That was an interesting time in the mid-90s. A whole bunch of factors came together sort of to restart our look at Mars, from the Burns Report to, as you mentioned, ALH, of course, the success of Pathfinder and Sojourner. Now, at the CSA, one of the advantages that you have is that there are actually analogs of some of the instruments that MSL has carried with it to Mars. So there's a LIBS and an XRD and a few other things.
Right.
So what kind of work happens at CSA with these instruments? What's the purpose?
Right. Well, you know, each of those instruments or the instruments we have may have been acquired or for different reasons, but I've basically corralled them to basically perform MSL-like investigations by using a combination of instruments. So, for instance, the LIBS and XRF instrument to give elemental composition, a portable Kemin-like X-ray diffraction instrument to give the crystallographic and mineralogical information. We have a prototype microscope, which has a UV LED, just like on Mali. So we can start integrating the data from those instruments and looking at analog materials of things we expect to find, perhaps, at Gale Crater, and try and see what are the capabilities and limitations of those instruments on their own and used in synergy. And at the same time, posing science questions about certain materials in these analog samples that we have.
I guess the idea here is we want to make sure that we can recognize these things when we actually come across them on Mars.
Right. Absolutely. So, for instance, the Kemin instrument, which is basically an X-ray diffractometer, marvelous piece of instrumentation, how they miniaturized it. Basically, every geology department in the world has one of these instruments, but it's quite large. Kemin is very small, obviously, but it has a limitation of only looking at samples in powder form, in what we call random bulk powders. So in some cases, we would prefer to orient samples, especially for clay minerals, for instance, to really get at details of the crystallographic nature and the mineral identity of those minerals. But we're a little bit limited with Kemin, for instance. So what are those limitations, really, for the kinds of minerals we're looking at, and can we differentiate them from similar minerals and really identify them definitively? Because, as I was saying earlier, in some cases, the exact mineral identity will be critical for understanding the processes that led to its formation and the conditions under which it formed.
It's interesting work, and we wish you all the best on MSL. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to Dr. John's interview with Richard Leveillé from the Canadian Space Agency, and he was talking about how he's involved with looking at particular minerals, specifically clay minerals, on Orion Gale Crater on Mars when MSL lands or has landed. He was involved in studying these clay materials in Gale Crater with MSL, and specifically using ChemCam. Of course, there are other instruments that have looked at this kind of stuff before on Mars, from satellites and stuff, so maybe Parshadi, you can tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, in my undergrad, I actually took a course in remote sensing, which is what these orbiters actually do. They remote sense and use spectroscopy to map out the minerals present on the surface of whatever object it is. When I did this course, they actually gave us a random place, which we weren't told the place about, and it's a picture, and you have the spectrograph. From the spectroscopy, you need to figure out what kind of materials are present, and then you color code it and understand what kind of geology actually occurred in those plains or desert or valleys, whatever that is. And the same thing is being done on Mars using the orbiters until now. Now that MSL is going to land, ChemCam would actually do it while present in the crater. So probably doing the crater walls, understanding what kind of materials are present there, understanding what kind of geology is actually present, especially the clay minerals. He's studying the clay minerals, which can be really important because they can only form in terms of presence of water. It'll be very useful to see if the crater, which is an impact, when actually it was created, if it actually had any water. ChemCam is going to be very, very useful to detect if there is any presence of water in previous ages of Mars.
Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about having MSL on the ground, of course, is that it can go to different locations and get...
drive around.
Yeah, and get measurements, and of course, more accurate measurements. For example, the orbiters that we've had in the past.
Both the orbiter and the lander can be very useful because now you're mapping from the top up when you're using the orbiter. While when you're in the crater, when you're using the orbiter, you cannot actually see at all the walls of the crater. You're actually doing it from the top, but now if you have a lander, you can actually see the walls which are being blocked in the orbiter pictures. Having two different kinds of images would actually help us pin out a lot of different kinds of minerals that are present there.
And the lander's going to be able to dig in a little bit too, right?
Yeah, so that is another thing. What is present under the surface of this impact crater would be also essential to study what is present under these kinds of layers on Mars.
Yeah, subsurface water is talked about a lot for Mars.
I guess one interesting thing he talked about in this interview was, of course, a theme that we've been revisiting throughout Western World's interviews is using information and studies on the Earth and then knowing or applying that information to places like Mars or
elsewhere. We've talked to a couple geologists who have ended up working on Mars missions and bringing a lot of the insight in the actual mineralogy.
And it's actually very interesting to see that his PhD actually started with something that was more terrestrial work than it extended to now Martians.
Right, he wasn't planning on going into planetary science or something. It just happened that his research area was very useful for Mars exploration.
Any study that is being done on Earth can be extended to not only Mars, but as he said, like the other systems like Venus and Mercury and Titan, and you don't know what's present out there. Like studying,
they all have minerals.
Yeah, they all have minerals.
They sure do.
So studying our own Earth can give us a lot of insight of what's present out there.
Mm-hmm. And in a lot of these places on Earth, we see these organisms that can thrive in these very strange environments that even a few years ago or 50 years ago or whatever, we didn't think that there would be things being able to live there. And so it gives us a really good indication of what kind of environments organisms can live and thrive in.
If there are any organisms present on Mars, or if they were, what kind of organisms that would be, because like organisms in volcanic would have higher pH, I would assume, then...
Right, and this ties in with the whole extremophile thing again, right? Because we do see organisms on Earth that can survive a very, very high acidity. Of course, I can't remember the exact numbers he said for Mars, but it seems like it's a neutral pH level on Mars for the most part, kind of anywhere from 5 to 8 or something like that.
Not a lot of activity,
yeah,
really.
It's not really extreme. But of course, we wouldn't be particularly happy at
high pH. Yeah, like, it can tell us a lot about what was present before, you know, acidity or pH levels can, now since people are debating life on Mars, past life on Mars, indicators like this can be really helpful to understand what, if at all it was present, what kind of life it actually existed. Mm-hmm. Having, if it's acidic, what kind of life forms can we expect or were present?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Martian meteorite that I think he mentioned that people thought had signs of life in it. Eventually, it turned out that was just a particular form of mineralogy, right?
Mm-hmm. So understanding these kinds of pH and the minerals present can be very useful in pinpointing what kind of life, if at all, existed, what kind of life was present. Could have been present, or was it a dead planet?
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Parshdi Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Michelle Parsons, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.